어떤 해서 공부해서 So, good afternoon, everybody. I'm chairing today's seminar, and I think I'm sure it is the first seminar in 2020, but I think it's the last seminar in the. Let me start again. So good afternoon, everybody. I'm chairing today's seminar. It's the first seminar in 2020, but I think it's the last seminar in this academic semester. The topic of the seminar is two presentations given by PhD students. Each of them has 20 minutes, so it's like a mini conference, and you are free to ask questions maybe throughout the talk or afterwards at the latest. The first one is actually a student of mine, Ivana Kvapilíková, and she'll be talking about her topic, which is unsupervised machine translation, and it will also include the things that she has explored while visiting the University of Basque Country.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thank you for attending my talk. Okay, one technical thing. How can I move the slides? Just from here? Or is there a... Okay, I will just do it from here. Okay, so in this talk, in the beginning, I will give you a little bit of background about unsupervised machine translation. I will talk about the importance of cross-lingual pre-training. Then I will go on to describe the training pipeline of unsupervised MT models. And finally, I will share with you some of the results of experiments that I've done in the recent months. And I will present you the research plan that I have for my PhD. The topic of my dissertation is towards machine translation based on monolingual corpora, which in other words means unsupervised machine translation. My supervisor is Ondra Bojar, and I am currently in the second year of my PhD. To give you the idea behind unsupervised machine translation. So traditionally we train machine translation systems on examples of translated sentences which were already generated by humans, ideally professional translators. The problem is that for many languages around the world or for many language pairs, these pre-translated sentences are not available, and they would be very expensive to get, because to have a parallel corpus to be able to train a machine translation system, we need a substantial amount of text translated by professional translators. Therefore, there is a lot of motivation to design a system that would train itself only from monolingual texts, which are usually easily available for most languages. This topic is quite a new one. Around 2 years ago, it still seemed like a crazy idea that this could ever work. But now, recent research has shown that actually it is possible to train a machine translation system only from monolingual texts. So how does it work? How do we do it that we move from two unrelated monolingual corpora to the cross-lingual space of machine translation? So the first approach to enter the cross-lingual space is to train monolingual embeddings in two languages independently, and later align these two embedding spaces by some kind of a mapping. There are several unsupervised ways how to learn this mapping. One of them is based on adversarial training, and the other one is based on focusing on some anchor words which are identical in the two languages, and then using iterative self-learning to improve the mapping. The underlying assumption of this approach is that is that monolingual embedding spaces are isomorphic, which means that that the structure of the embedding spaces is approximately the same across languages. It is schematically illustrated in the picture here, and in practice, this was not proved to work 100% for all language pairs, but approximately it should hold. Here you can see a sort of a real life example where we were aligning a Czech and a German monolingual space using the iterative self-learning approach. And I am showing it here on an example of the Czech and German spaces and focusing on the word sagte, which is the German translation of the word said. And here, by looking into the nearest neighbors of this word, you can see that all the words around are somehow related to the activity of saying something or claiming or announcing something. And now, the fact that this holds monolingually is a property of the word-to-vec model, which was used to generate the monolingual embeddings. But the fact that within these nearest neighbors, we can actually see the real translations, the correct translations of the word sagt or sagte, which in Czech is řekl, that is the consequence of a correct mapping. From a cross-lingual space like this, it is possible to derive like a bilingual lexicon from these examples, and these can be directly used to bootstrap an unsupervised phrase-based system. Another type of cross-lingual pre-training that I'm going to be talking about is not pre-training only the word embeddings, but actually pre-training an entire language model. So the primary examples of a cross-lingual language model are XLM and MBERT. They are both cross-lingual language models, which means that they were trained on sentences in different languages, but these sentences are not aligned in any way. It's just unrelated sentences concatenated together, and then using this training data to train a language model, the authors are able to train a cross-lingual language model which understands the structure of all the languages that it has been trained on. The training objective of this model is the masked language model objective, which means that the model is trained on sentences where we first mask some random tokens from the input sentences, and we train the model to be able to predict the missing words and fill in the blanks. In that way, the model learns to predict each word not only from their left context, but from actually the bilingual the bidirectional context, which seems to be an important factor for the cross-lingual ability of the model. What is important to note here is that the model is not trained with any kind of a cross-lingual objective. So there is no explicit alignment, and the model is free to choose how to represent the languages, which could be in like a different separate subspaces or somehow jointly. And this question of how the model actually represents the individual sentences and whether there is some cross-lingual knowledge, that is an attractive research question that was asked, whether this model, the multilingual bird, is actually multilingual. The answer seems to be yes. It was shown on on some downstream tasks such as named entity recognition or natural language inference, that the model is actually able to transfer the knowledge between sentences, between languages. And when we take the pre-trained cross-lingual model and we fine-tune it, for example, on English data to recognize named entities, then later at inference time, the model is able to transfer this knowledge that it learned on English names, to transfer it to different languages and recognize, for example, German names or names in other languages. So this seems to be a proof of some cross-lingual transfer, of some cross-lingual knowledge of the model. Another way to look at it is to somehow visualize the internal representations of the model. For example, here in the picture, you see something like a positive example of language agnostic representations, where the nearest neighbors of each sentence in a representation space are its translations. So the representation depends more on the meaning of the underlying sentence rather than the language it was originally expressed in. We wanted to explore this, and this is the work that I was doing during my research stay in Spain. We were exploring how often is this the case that the model represents the words or sentences in some sort of a language neutral way. So we took 3,000 parallel sentences, 3,000 sentences translated in English, German, and Czech, and we wanted to have a look whether, when we encode these sentences, whether the model will be able to match the corresponding translation pairs by performing a nearest neighbor search. The results of this task, so task of matching parallel sentences, is here in this chart. It shows the success rate of the model to recover these translation pairs across its layers. So we were looking at the representations, the internal representations that the multilingual model has for the encoded sentences, and we saw that when we actually look at how does MBERT represent these sentences at its deeper layers, around fifth to last layer, and we use these representations to try to find the translation pairs, that in 90% of cases we are able to. This ability is, of course, also depends a little bit on different languages. It seems to be that for some languages it is easier to cross-lingually aligned representations. For some language pairs it seems to be more difficult, like for Czech and English, for example. It shows that the alignment is not as successful. That leads to another question about where does this cross-lingual ability actually come from, given that the models are not trained with any cross-lingual objective, and what does it depend on? So the initial hypothesis was that an important factor is the number of overlapping words in the two sentences that we are trying to in the two languages that we are trying to model. That means, for example, names or numbers or some URLs. And this hypothesis was actually later disproved, because the authors tried to train a cross-lingual model on two languages with exactly zero word overlap, and it turns out that the cross-lingual transfer is still there. So the word overlap is not the likely cause of the cross-lingual ability.
The more likely source of this ability is in the structural similarity of the languages. So their morphology, word ordering, or word frequencies. Also, an important factor of this cross-lingual pre-training is that that there is a parameter sharing between when modeling the two languages. So that seems to be the one of the most important factors, together with the depth of the network. Okay, so this was about how do we even enter the cross-lingual space from the monolingual corpora. And now I would like to describe how we actually train the translation model itself. So in case of unsupervised neural machine translation models, we have an encoder-decoder architecture where we use the pre-trained XLM model to initialize both the encoder and the decoder. The model is multilingual, so the encoder and decoder, they're used for both translation directions. So for example, when translating for German to Czech and Czech to German, we are using the same encoder. So once we initialize it, we fine-tune it on two tasks. One of them is back translation and the other one is denoising. Back translation means that we use the model to generate its own training data, which means that we first use it to translate a batch of sentences, and then we use this batch of like synthetic translation pairs to train the model in the other translation direction. So in this way, we are able to iteratively improve the quality during training. The other subtask is called denoising. It's just a multilingual objective whereby we're training the model to reconstruct a corrupted sentence. So we feed the model with some sort of noised versions of input data, and we train it to reconstruct the correct sentences. This objective teaches the model to understand the structure of the language and to produce more fluent outputs. In an unsupervised phrase-based model, that's another very different approach. We use what I already mentioned earlier when talking about the cross-lingual embedding spaces. So we use those to generate a lexicon or a phrase table. We can also use the cosine distances between different words as an indicator of the probability of these translation pairs. And that is already the most important component of the unsupervised phrase-based model. The other important component is a language model, which we train on the target language. But there is no difference from the supervised scenario because language model is always trained on monolingual data. So there is nothing special there. And just from these two components and some other features of phrase-based modeling, we are able to get an initial phrase-based model, which can later be also improved, similarly to the case of the neural MT, with back translation. So using the reverse model to generate sentences that this model is later trained on. Okay, so now I would like to show you how do these models that I just now described, how do they perform in practice. We measured this on the Czech-German language pair. We are comparing here the unsupervised phrase-based model that I was now talking about with the unsupervised neural model initialized from XLM. And finally, one more model, which is a neural one, and it is trained on a synthetic parallel corpus, which was generated by the first model by the phrase-based one. So we use the phrase-based model to generate a synthetic corpus, and then we use it to train a supervised NMT model. So from these three, the highest blue scores are achieved by the purely neural one, which is the blue score that we achieved from German to Czech is 16. But then when we compare ourselves to the winner of the WMT unsupervised task from last year, there is still quite some discrepancy there. They achieved 17.8. And what they did is that they actually combined the both the pre-training by XLM and the training on the synthetic corpus from unsupervised phrase-based model. So it's kind of like a combination of the two, showing that these hybrid models actually have quite a lot of potential for further improving translation quality. Also, what's interesting to see here is that this this model from LMU actually performs quite a bit better than when we translate the sentences via English. So when we use two models and translate in sequence. Also, what can be observed from here is that the when training a supervised benchmark, it achieved around 20.8 blue score for German to Czech, and which means that the difference or the gap between unsupervised and supervised MT is really getting smaller. Here to not get overly optimistic about the results, I prepared a couple of one sentence translated by the models that that I trained, and what you can see here is that the different models make different mistakes. So, for example, the phrase-based models seem to have a big issue with names, with named entities. Here, all of these are translations of a sentence from newspaper or article about the Hurricane Rosa, which is weakening over the cooler waters of the north coast of Mexico. And here, in the phrase-based models, it's they're translating the names completely wrong as Milada or something else. And however, then when we look at the neural-based model, the neural model, that one is getting the name right, but it's actually the rest of the sentence is probably even worse than the others. It seems to be hallucinating some extra words into the sentence. So from this, it seems that the models are making different mistakes. So maybe combining them all could have some other research work already showed that it could have some positive impact on the final translation quality. To conclude, I would like to tell you what my plan is, what I would now like to focus on. So as I was saying, I would like to focus on the on some kind of effective combination of phrase-based and neural unsupervised models. Then I would like to look more into the proper alignment of language representation spaces, because the examples that I showed, they're showing that the alignment is possible and that it's somehow working, but there's definitely room for improvement. And finally, I would like to conclude what I already started and maybe look deeper in it. That's the cross-lingual sentence embeddings. So I would like to see whether it's possible to use these for maybe filtering comparable corpora, or maybe to use them during unsupervised MT training, for example, to score the synthetic translations generated during MT training for the unsupervised systems. Okay, so that's it. Thank you for attention.
As a supervisor, I'm obviously biased and very happy about both the content, the work that you have done, and also the way you presented it. So let's ask the audience if someone has maybe some other opinions or questions or anything. Any question?
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. It was very nice. I was wondering, when you talked about combining the models, have you tried or are you thinking about just ensembling the neural models? You know, just using the same model multiple times, if that helps a bit.
Yeah, I haven't tried it, and it is definitely an option to try that. Some of the other participants of the last year WMT tried it, and they did report some improvements, but it still seems that the most improvement is achieved by combining the phrase based and the neural. But yeah, probably at least some improvement should definitely be okay. Be possible.
Thanks.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. It was quite clear. And I wanted to maybe a bit of a clarification. The phrase base is working on the word level translation, right? Mm-hmm. Does the neural machine translation works also on the word level or the subword level? And if you think there would be difference, mm-hmm. except for the BLAS score, but by performing on the same words.
So the phrase based is based on words or phrases. The neural model is based on subwords. And actually, initially, I think the initial neural models were trained on word units, and now there was quite a lot of improvement with the cross-lingual pre-training, which is happening on the subwords, and I think that's probably the only way to go there. So I guess, it would be interesting to look into basing the phrase-based model on subwords and not on words to maybe get more of a comparability there. Even though I'm not sure how, because aligning the word embedding spaces seems quite intuitive to me on word level or phrase level. I wonder how it works on the subword level, but it would be interesting to explore for sure. Thanks.
Are there any further questions? I have one related to embedded. Mm-hmm. So if I'm correct, and you said it, it's trained on pairs of random sentences, one English sentence, one Czech sentence, and they are not related to each other at all. Are there any papers, any work that would bootstrap with this? So I understand that you do not want to use parallel data at all because mm-hmm. you want to build methods that simply do not need parallel data to mm-hmm. start with. But you can create synthetic data with some first stage of the model, and then you could run embedded and train it on both these random pairs and also the good pairs. That way mm-hmm. help the model to be more multilingual by itself. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anybody has tried that or if it's an interesting...
No, I haven't seen this. So the XLM version of this cross-lingual training, there is one objective which is for parallel sentences, which is able to, which has an explicit cross-lingual objective. But I don't think I've seen anywhere feeding this
synthetic
model
corpus.
With a certain synthetic corpus. I don't think I've seen it. So
that might help.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. So any further questions? If not, then let's thank Ivana. Thank Ivana again. And we'll do a little bit of juggling with the microphones because the next speaker is Jonáš, and he's going to present again something multilingual or benefiting from language similarity of linguistic structure across sentences. And I can make use of this time while you are switching the microphones to warn about this link again. In the background, we are trying to recognize what is being spoken and and the non-native English is often misrecognized. No linguistic terms are in the dictionary, so all the birds, all the multilingual embeddings are totally misrecognized. But anyway, the bad English is then translated into 6 or 7 output languages, including Hungarian. So if you are curious to see how this is failing, then there are 2 links in this Google document, and we are happy to receive any feedback there. You didn't know it, but Ivana was subject to one more test. The test was concerning the microphone position. So she was wearing 2 microphones. One of the microphones was close to her mouth, and the other one was here on the chest. And we will measure the success of the speech recognition depending on the microphone position as well. We already know from a 3-minute test I did on myself that the mouth microphone is better, but it does play a difference. And as I said, it's that centimeters make difference to the ASR. Like if I move the mic too close to my mouth, suddenly the quality will drop considerably. There is my voice being repeated, and we are doing the same test with Jonas. So thanks for that. And with that, I'm happy to hand and stick it down. To jste si tam píchl. To
máš vlastní prezentace.
So I'll give the technique a few more seconds. Let's not touch it, and let's listen to the second presentation of this microconference, which is on derivational networks.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. I'm Jonáš Vidra, and the title of my thesis that I'm going to present now, or at least the future work into the thesis, is semi-supervised machine learning methods for developing derivation networks. And since the title of my thesis is quite likely to raise some questions, I'll address them by first talking about what is derivation, and by giving you a few examples of existing derivation networks. It works now. Good. So then I'm going to talk about how derivational networks are traditionally developed using manual annotations, and then I'll introduce my ideas of how to do it automatically, or at least mostly automatically. And I've grouped those methods into 2 kind of overarching approaches. One of them concerns the methods that work with a single language only, that predict the derivations inside the language, and a second group of methods that will, I hope, will transfer knowledge from one language to another and bootstrap a derivation network in one language using an existing derivation network in another one. And then I'll address 2 kind of auxiliary but also important topics. One of them is how are derivational trees different from syntactic trees, because there has been some recent research into unsupervised syntactic tree parsing and on cross-lingual syntactic tree parsing. So I'll address that, and I'll also talk about the evaluation methods for my task, mostly about the ones that are not suitable despite seeming being seemingly good. So, derivation is a way of creating new words out of existing ones by affixation. So, for example, you can create the word owner from the word to own by adding the suffix er. And derivation works recursively, so the word owner can again become the base of more derived words, such as ownership or co-owner. The derivation relations can thus be seen through the optics of graph theory as forming edges over a set of words. And this set of edges and a set of words is the derivational network that my thesis is going to be about. It's a kind of word formation network. More specifically, this is a derivational network because it only contains derivations. The network is not a simple forest, though, because although the derivations are recursive, they can also form non-tree structures, such as directed acyclic graphs, because, for example, the word reprintable can be derived either from the word to reprint or from the word printable. You can decide to kind of force this into a tree shape by forgetting about one of the links or by ignoring one of them, saying that one of them is auxiliary or that one of them is the primary one, and you can force a tree-shaped structure on the links this way, but sometimes the decision can be hard, and also in many cases you will find examples that look alike, but the natural decisions that you would want to do would be different. So it might be worthwhile to include all the links in the network. Also, sometimes the direction of the derivation is not clear. For example, in the pair of words hallucinate and hallucination, the etymological or historical relation goes one way, but the synchronous natural direction of derivation goes the other way. So either you have to decide whether you want to favor synchronous regularity, or whether you want to favor diachronic regularity, or you have to include both links. So derivational networks are mostly tree-shaped, but there are some exceptional cases that make them general graphs. An example of such a network is the Czech Derinet, but there are many others. Our colleague Lukáš Kiánek has recently created a survey of 50 networks in 22 languages, and I'm sure that he has come up with some other examples since then, or he has found new networks since then. And he also did a huge work of harmonizing 10 of them into the same file format and into the same structure, which was released as the Universal Derivations Collection in the last year. Here you can see examples of a single word and its derivational neighborhood from those 10 languages. And the word is to evaluate, translated into each of the 10 languages. And immediately you can notice huge differences between the languages. For example, cluster sizes. The tree for Czech is, which is here on the right, it's not very well visible, but you can kind of see the overall shape, I hope, even from the back. This tree is several times larger than all of the other trees combined. And other obvious differences include, for example, different writing system. For example, the tree for Farsi is written using the Arabic writing system. So the language differences are big, even though all the, or except for Farsi, all the languages are from Europe. These differences are caused both by linguistic reasons, such as the productivity of derivation, where in English you are likely to only see small trees because the word formation processes work differently there, whereas in Czech derivation is highly productive and most Czech words or most of the Czech lexicon is created by derivation. But there are also reasons that are outside language, that are caused by, let's say, design decisions by the authors of those networks. In Czech, we use a huge lexicon as the basis for the network, which is why it's so big. The lexicon contains even words that are unattested in corpora. They are well formed, but only potential. Whereas most other resources focus only on attested words, and then only on specific, let's say, linguistic phenomena. For example, in Portuguese, the only types of derivations that are included are verb to noun derivations. So it doesn't list any adjectives. At least I think it doesn't even now. It certainly didn't in the version that we have here. So how does one create a derivational network? Basically, the way we do it in Derinet, there are many possibilities, but as an example, what we did is that first we try to notice some hole in the network that's mostly shaped like some linguistic phenomenon. Then we automatically create data that would mostly fit into the hole and is mostly correct. But we usually use regular expressions and like manual suffix manipulation to achieve that. Then we manually annotate those candidates by either commenting out wrong ones or adding missing examples. And then we manually create a step in our building pipeline, which takes those annotations, adds them into the network, and performs some checks that the result is correct. And then you go and address another phenomenon. Especially steps 1 and 3 require a lot of linguistic insight, and they require a lot of work. Therefore, they are very expensive in terms of time and effort mostly, but also in terms of money. And moreover, for most languages, even if we had the resources and especially the money to cover them, it would be very difficult to get reasonable annotations for them. Because outside the best studied, let's say, 50 world languages, in most of them, there is no consensus on what is derivation, what is inflection, how those two differ from one another. Usually, you don't even have lemmatizers. For many languages, you don't really have a linguistic framework that would enable you to go and build a derivation network. You would first have to study the language and decide what you actually want to do, and only then you can do the annotations. I'd like to simplify those processes, and I would like to mostly automate them. My ultimate goal is to make the process so easy and cheap that I could apply it to tens of languages and create many networks at once without having to understand the languages themselves. This is, of course, a bold claim because you can't really replace linguistic insight. I expect and I accept the fact that the resulting data will be of a rather low quality from the linguistic viewpoint, but I still hope that it could be used to facilitate some research into language typology, for example. But this is basic research, and I don't really have a clear application in mind. And the journey is the destination here. And the goal of my thesis is twofold. So first, I want to create the data itself, but I also mostly want to develop the methods for obtaining the data. I've already spoken that there are two major pathways to be explored here, or that I've grouped the methods into two major pathways. It is monolingual derivation prediction and cross-lingual transfer. The former approach, the monolingual prediction, is the better studied one, with preliminary research already done by me and Lukáš Kiánek, Mateusz Lango, and abroad by, for example, Burku Khan, Suresh Manandar, and countless others. And this research has already shown viability of even pretty simple machine learning methods, if you have some training data available. The latter approach, the cross-lingual transfer, has not been extensively studied so far. I basically don't know about any research into this specific area. There is some research into, for example, cognates, which is not exactly derivation, but it's quite close. Some pilot experiments have been conducted by Jan Fariat and Lukáš Kiánek, who both study here. And I hope that this approach can be used to kickstart the monolingual methods for languages where we don't have any training data available. And now I'll explain both of these approaches, starting with the monolingual one. And I'll try to explain various ways in which I hope to create the derivation networks. So, the monolingual prediction can theoretically be done in an entirely unsupervised way. For example, by segmenting the words and then finding words with closest morphematic representations. This method yields general graphs as the output. I've tried this on check, and even with the best segmenters out there, or with the best unsupervised morphological segmenters out there, I couldn't get it to work. So maybe this method could work for languages with simpler morphologies, such as Turkish, but definitely not for Czech. I mean, simpler in terms of how many hurdles to unsupervised parsing there are. Supervised approaches, on the other hand, work pretty well. I've tried applying pairwise binary prediction by simply making a decision for each pair of words, whether they are derived from one another or not. That is, for every word in the dictionary, I try every other word, I feed them all into a binary prediction machine learning method, and all the results that are over a threshold are considered to be derivations. This achieves 92% accuracy, which is wonderful, but I've trained it on the whole Derinet data, or, well, on the test portion of the or training portion of the Derinet data, and I've tested on a small subset of Derinet. So if you feed it huge data, it works. Doesn't work as well when the data is smaller, but it still is able to work even with smaller input networks. A refinement of this method, which yields trees only by applying some maximum spanning tree algorithm, can be obtained from the output of the previous method. This method should outperform the previous one because it will remove many superfluous links. As I've said, the clusters are general graphs, but mostly tree-shaped. So if we force them to be tree-shaped, the output should be better. I haven't tried this method yet, but I hope it's promising. But it's a very minor step. It's a small iteration. So a more major step is not doing an O(n) squared algorithm by trying all possible word pairs, but predicting the parents directly from a given word using a neural network that predicts them character-wise. This also yields a general graph-shaped structure, and when trained on the full Derinet data, it achieves 90% accuracy, so it's nearly as good as the simpler machine learning that does point-wise prediction. The problem is that it stops working very fast if the size of the data gets smaller. A completely different approach, again, is by not using sort of advanced machine learning, but by simply utilizing word embeddings and doing, let's say, minimally supervised approach just on the embeddings themselves. The idea is that words that are derivationally related with the same process have similar differences in embeddings. So the embeddings of the words drive and driver have some difference between them, and this difference is similar to make maker or read reader. And it's completely different from, for example, close closer, because although those words share the same, let's say, affixal pattern or pseudo-affixal pattern, the meaning shift is different, so the derivation is different, and therefore the embedding difference is different. This can be theoretically used to generate new derivations by learning the expected differences and then trying to apply them to unconnected words. But I expect that it will require heavy post-processing because it's likely to overgenerate a lot. And because those pairwise methods that work very well are really computationally intensive, you have to iterate over the square of the whole lexicon, it might be worthwhile to do some pre-processing to kind of decrease the complexity. One method is to first apply clustering, obtain the derivational families, and only find links within a single family, because we can be sure that there are no links that would cross derivational families. If we could first cluster the lexemes, then the whole method will be easier. Unfortunately, I was unable to find a word similarity metric that would work here. The simple ones such as Levenstein and Jahr-Winkler are just too simple. And more advanced metrics that I found in the recent literature are tailored towards finding alternative representations of the same word. So, for example, spelling correction or fixing typos, but not towards finding other words that are similar. We could also do the clustering by utilizing the neural network that predicts words, but just predict root morphemes. I haven't tried this. I hope it would work, but we'll see. The reason why the distance metrics have problems is basically this. If you apply a distance metric to those four words, you would like for kuň and koník to be close to one another, and steak and peg to be close to one another, but you would like kuň and kůl to be far away. I just haven't found any distance metric in the literature that would allow me to do this. So one of the subtasks in my thesis will be to kind of explore this and try to find something that works, but we'll see. I expect that the way to go is to first morphologically segment the words and then perform or find a metric that works on the morpheme level. However, because we don't have the network, the derivational network at this point, it requires unsupervised segmentation, and as I've said, unsupervised segmentation is not very good, at least the ones that I've seen. So now, the cross-lingual methods. There are several options for transferring knowledge across languages. The most basic option is to just take an existing resource and somehow translate it into another language. This should work thanks to the fact that derivationally related words are also related semantically. And semantics should be more or less transferable between languages, and it should be more or less kept in translation. Of course, this is not perfect. So, for example, the fact that the word letadlo is derived from the verb letat in Czech doesn't mean that when you translate the words into English, you will get a derivational pair, because airplane is not derived from fly in English. It's a compound word that's derived from air and plane. Again, post-processing in the target language is required. You have to verify that the translation actually satisfies some string similarity, or that the words have similar morpheme structure. There are some smaller questions regarding this method. For example, whether to translate the existing resource into the new language and project the links that way, or whether to go the other way around, translate the words from the new language into an existing language, find the links there, and then copy them over to the new language side. There are differences regarding precision and recall, because the former, the existing to new, means that we may not cover the whole vocabulary of the new language. So for recall, we should prefer translating from the new language to the existing one. But if the existing resource doesn't cover the whole language, for example, the Portuguese resource, which only has verbs and nouns and not, for example, adjectives, it might be worthwhile to translate the other way so that you get higher precision. Another question is how to choose the source language. Or the best source language for any given target, or how to combine multiple sources. As we've heard several weeks ago in Tom Kotsmith's PhD defense, maybe the best option will be to just try every possible source, and if possible then combine them and combine the results, because even languages that are pretty far away from one another can maybe help. So it would be good to perform multi-source translation. I will certainly work on that. It's one of the biggest goals, I believe. But so far, I'm just starting to look into this. And a completely different option is to perform transfer learning of the monolingual machine learning methods. So we could just train a monolingual method on one language and then somehow transfer the model. This obviously mirrors the work of Rudarosa, which he's done on his dissertation on semi-supervised syntactic parsing. So I'll go to the differences in syntactic parsing now. Basically, both tasks should take a set of words and produce trees on that set of words. So there is a big similarity right there, but there are also many differences. The first one is the amount of data that is available, because for syntactic parsing, which has been studied for a number of years, you get hundreds of languages, and tens of them have very large tree banks. Whereas in word formation or in derivational networks, you have basically three languages with major networks and less than 30 languages that have them at all. Also, the potential data is different, because for syntactic parsing, you can theoretically annotate any running text and get more data. Whereas in derivational networks, you have a finite vocabulary, and finding out what the vocabulary is might not be that easy, because the boundaries are kind of fuzzy. There are some words that are potential but not existing in corpora, and you want to include them. Other such words you want to exclude. Also, there are computational problems, because the tree size is different. In syntactic parsing, sentences don't really have a uniform length, but the average is somewhere around 15 words. Whereas in word formation, many derivational clusters have thousands of words. Because of that, the complexity is different. In parsing, you can use the limit on sentence length to your advantage, because the complexity is basically, for every sentence you produce one tree, so the sentence is in the length of the, or the complexity is in the length of the sentence. But in word formation, any word can potentially link to any other one in the dictionary, so the complexity has to be calculated against the dictionary size, which is much higher. Also, derivation trees have a few constraints. In parsing, you can rely on the fact that the parse trees are typically projective, but in word formation, you don't have linear semantics on the dictionary, so that doesn't hold. You can approximate the derivational trees by string and embedding similarity, which is a plus, similar to how in parsing you can use linear adjacency, for example, right branching trees. But again, the space of similar words is much higher here. Also, the research into word formation is fairly recent. The oldest papers are about 10 years old. Whereas in parsing, even the multilingual approaches have been studied for many years. As for the evaluation, the obvious metrics that I'm going to use are unlabeled attachment score, or basically unlabeled attachment score, which is simple accuracy of assigning the parent. And also, because many of the methods don't have to assign a parent to a word, it might be worthwhile to do precision and recall. This is fairly obvious, I would say. But what might not be so obvious is that using clustering scores might not be ideal, because of what was on the previous slide, that the sizes of the clusters are highly variable. So when you include a single wrong link that connects two big clusters together that should not be connected, those scores fall down a lot. While if you include a very similar link that just happens to link two tiny clusters, the difference in the scores is going to be small. So the clustering scores, I believe, are not so applicable on the task. And now to end my talk, I want to talk a bit about what I believe are the biggest challenges in the thesis, and at least the ones that I anticipate kind of outside researching the main machine learning methods. So the first issue is how to lemmatize a corpus, because as I've said, most languages don't have these kinds of resources, and I will have to research them myself. Some work on this has been done by Rudarosa in his recent work on unsupervised lemmatization, so I would like to get into that as well, and maybe try to find some or evaluate his methods on multiple languages, and maybe try to improve them. Apart from lemmatization, we have the typical dictionary building issues: which words to include, which not to include. For example, with the German spelling reform that has occurred 20 years ago or 30 years ago, building a dictionary for German requires separating texts into old ones and new ones, and if possible then correcting the old ones to use the new spelling. Otherwise you get a lot of duplicate words that should be the same entity, but in the dictionary they will be separate. And also the word translation methods that are required for the cross-lingual transfer are not very well studied. I found Giza++ to work the best out of all the approaches that I've tried. There are some recent papers on this, surprisingly, in the era of neural machine translation. For example, the paper by Alexis Connell and his colleagues, which is called Word Translation Without Parallel Data. It uses the multilingual embeddings that we've heard about 20 minutes ago. I'm currently trying to replicate its results, so far unsuccessfully, but I've only started doing it a few weeks ago. Also, the lack of resources for most languages complicates things a lot. Most languages lack even a theory of word formation. So it's completely impossible to gather some test data for the task in that language. I hope I'll overcome these problems, at least somewhat. So please wish me good luck. And with that, I'd like to thank you for listening.
I will come back to the example with Kuhn and Kuhl. I would recommend you not to try to compare Kuhn and Kuhl, because Kuhl, not cool, because there are two short words, and I think, but linguists will be more sure, that words that have only one syllable are usually roots. And I am not sure if it is reasonable to compare, to try to compare roots.
Sure,
I mean,
but
morphologically.
Like Konik and colleague is still a problem.
Yes, but not Kuhn and Kuhl.
Yeah, you're right. There are some optimizations that could be done here. But in general, the problem still holds. You can find many pairs of words that differ in a single letter, but have completely different meanings and are completely unrelated. I apologize for choosing a bad example here. You're right.
I'd like to ask if you go to the just preceding slide about the accuracy, like how exactly did you measure it? Is it this attachment score?
Yeah,
or
it's unlabeled attachment score, basically.
And like the set of things you measured this on is just a single derivation family. Right.
I've sampled the derivational families from Derinet into two sets: the mm-hmm. training set and the test set. Oh, well, that was the development.
Okay. So the main point is you have a set of words that are all related somehow, and your only task is to build the correct structure.
Not really. I look at them kind of point wise. So for each word, I try to predict its parent, or say that there is none when the word is actually a root.
So for each word, you basically have, like, let's say, like 10,000 words, and for each of the words, it's like a 10,000 way classification.
Yes.
Telling this is the parent.
Kinda. Yeah.
Okay.
That's one way of looking at it. Obviously, mm-hmm. that formalization doesn't really work, which is why I didn't include it into this list. The formalizations that I found to work is the pairwise prediction, where you don't classify 10,000 way, but just
two way
on 10,000 possibilities.
You do it 10,000 times. Yeah.
Exactly.
Thanks.
Did I answer your question?
Yes, yes. I think that, yeah, that way the metric seems reasonable to me.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So, any further questions? I also had one related to the Koni-Kuni example, and that was, you've actually said it, the words Kuni and Koni are semantically related, and I might have missed it, but you haven't talked about any semantic criterion that you would consider. So do you consider any word embeddings or whatever?
Sure.
So how come that they don't spot that Kuni and Koni are close together and cool and Kuni are far away?
Well, this is basically what the work of Khan and Manandar is about, where they kind of simply look at the closest words embedding-wise and they consider them related. It obviously does mistakes such as linking king and queen together. So you always have to combine the criteria. Yeah, you're right. And it makes the task actually harder, not simpler, because it's not that you have two different criteria and you can choose which one fits the best, but you have two criteria and they both have to fit for the word to be derived. I use word embeddings in the neural networks, in the character-wise parent prediction. Kind of obviously, the Dirichlet network is not large enough to fully train the neural network, so I use pre-trained embeddings and start from there. I don't use them in the binary prediction, which was done using logistic regression, if I recall correctly, and it was done on character n-grams and word final strings of the two words. And it worked pretty well, so even without the embeddings. And yes, if I could somehow factor the embeddings into that machine learning method, it should work better. I didn't try that, but yes.
Yeah. Thank you. So, last option to ask. So if not, then let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.
I've checked the webpage and I don't find any notification, and the semester is actually over with this week, so probably I'm not sure. So that's yeah. So please follow the webpage of UFAL to find out.